Atkins v. Chicago, Mr. Longo.
Judge Posner, Judge Mannion, Judge Hamilton, good morning to you. Just a few points regarding the city defendants and then just a few points regarding the IDOC defendants. It can't be said that no set of facts can state a cause of action. Regarding the city defendants, what do we have here? We have a three-step process. We have a stop of a family minivan for no reason at all. They're on the way to a laundromat. We then have police officers go up to them with pointed guns, order them to get out. They're thrown against the family minivan. They're handcuffed. At that point, they're arrested. Later, they're brought to the back of the police car. A search is done. A warrant is found. The city argues on a motion to dismiss, they've got to accept our facts as true. Instead, they ignore it. They argue that the widow's husband was arrested when they found the warrant. He was arrested earlier. But even if we say that the warrant purged the illegal stop, remember, there's no traffic citations. Even if we say the warrant purged the wrongful arrest, handcuffing, etc., still, the warrant by itself does not justify this wrongful conduct. They had an obligation, when faced with facts that created doubt, to engage in reasonable avenues of investigation. They didn't. And probably because, and I would argue respectfully, that reasonable officers, I think, would have at least.
Well, what are we talking about? Are we talking about the conditions in the jail or something else?
The city defendants, Your Honor, at the point that they were stopped in the family minivan and arrested. And the point, I think the reason why these officers did not bother engage in some type of reasonable avenues of investigation is precisely because the city has no policies to address misidentifications. Though there's many cases against the city and have been for decades. Now, the city argues that we do have a policy, and the policy is that the desk sergeant compares the information in the report with the warrant. But the city conspicuously doesn't mention that the desk sergeant is even made aware that we have a brother and we have an innocent person saying, I've been misidentified. In fact, the city doesn't argue that anybody addresses claims of misidentification.
Mr. Longo, let me ask you, on the if the city had done a further check, whose Department of Correction number was on the parole violation warrant?
We don't know because we don't have full discovery to determine that.
I thought it was your client's number that it was mistakenly on there.
We don't know that. You know, the case was dismissed, on no set of facts, so we don't have full discovery.
Well, what was your client's DOC number? Surely that's available to you.
Yeah, I believe it was.
And so is it the same number or not?
It was not clear to me because he didn't remember what number it was. So, and the warrant just has the name of the wanted person, no description whatsoever. But without discovery, I don't know how these numbers are applied. If there's a mix-up in the numbers, I don't know. But we do know one thing, that the widow's husband had served his time a while ago. So our argument is that had they just contrasted fingerprints and photographs early on, the three appeals in this case would not have been necessary. Regarding the bedding issue, our claim is that there's no policy. So whether it's one night or two nights or three nights, it's almost irrelevant in some respect because there is no policy. This is not a situation in which there was overcrowding, there was an accident that they made them sleep on the floor. The city just doesn't have a policy to provide bedding. So for that reason, we believe that violates Mr. Atkins' rights. As far as the IDOC defendants, Walker is the director of the IDOC. He implemented no policies to address claims of misidentification, and for this reason, this man is jailed for 37 to 39 days days repeatedly protesting, please, contrast my fingerprints with the wanted person. You'll see I have the wrong man. But they refused. Now, maybe Walker could have instituted a policy saying, well, you can resort to state remedies. If somebody argues that they've been misidentified, well, then let's let them know what the state remedies are. But they don't even have such a policy. In fact, nowhere do they mention that they have such a policy. They have no policy. In fact, at the April 2007 oral argument, Judge Posner, you might remember that it was a few times yourself and your colleagues mentioned, well, how can this be? How can a man be in jail for 37 to 39 days and nothing's wrong? Procedures must be had. In fact, at that oral argument, it was mentioned that post-deprivation remedies are just deficient, particularly with you could remedy this with a few minutes by...
Why couldn't he apply for habeas corpus?
wasn't aware of it, and that's why I'm saying they had a policy to make him aware of it, as well as others. They could have then addressed it then. In fact...
Husband, the survivor. Where was she all of this time? The wife, I guess.
Where was she?
Yeah. What in these 37 days? Isn't somebody on the outside saying something? Or?
Nobody has money. Yeah.
Well, they're taking money to go in there, does it?
I'm sorry.
Then you couldn't. I mean, did she try? Did she do something? Was there?
Yes. The family was trying to get up. They had talked to Laura. They were trying to get money, and they finally were able to get money together. And they did hire a lawyer, and then he was with them at the Prisoner Review Board hearing where Mr. Atkins, the widow's husband, was released because they realized they had the wrong man.
Was that review board hearing at the Institute the lawyer initiated that, or was that something that's routine?
Well, it's my understanding that the widow's husband had asked for it throughout the entire 37 days he was at the IDOC. He wanted to go to court, he wanted to go to the Prisoner Review Board, but they wouldn't let him go. So at what point, was it his lawyer who was able to get it, or was it because he kept complaining? I don't know, Your Honor. But I do know that there was that hearing, and I do know that they released him at that hearing. So it wasn't a huge process. They released him like that. And that should have been done early on. Again, fingerprints could have done that, or some type of hearing early on. But you can't just throw somebody away.
Now, what about the... part of your complaint is your complaint about how he was treated in the jail.
Yes, ma'am.
And what you have one paragraph in your complaint says he was denied drinking water and or food for several days. What's that about?
And I'm glad you raised that. As a side matter, the state argues that he was only abused for 4 days. He was abused for 10 days. It was on the fourth.
I'm asking a very specific question about the eating and drinking.
Okay. He was denied water for several days. And
well, I don't understand that. You can't be denied water for several days.
He was.
Is this when he's in the dry cell?
Yes. He was in a cell in which he was naked.
Yeah, because he swallowed a diamond earring.
Right, exactly.
That was a dumb move.
but they can't. The state can't punish someone so abusively and chugging his butt.
I don't understand the water business. Why wouldn't they give him a glass of water? That doesn't have anything to do with... It's not as... I mean, for their purposes, they'd want him to drink as much as possible, right?
Jerron, you're presupposing that they're logically as opposed to not punitively.
I'm skeptical. No water for 4 days.
Mm-hmm. And as I said, checking his buttocks when he defecated in the pail the first time.
That's a separate point. I'm asking about the water and the food.
Yes, yes, no water.
We had supposed to drink milk. That was one of the weird things. Did you get milk instead of water?
No. After several days, he agreed to drink the milk, even though he was lactose intolerant.
At the risk of asking a practical question here, he has passed away. If we were to send this back for a trial, how would you prove this?
Very difficultly, but we do our best. We're trying to help
how?
Him as best as we can.
I
would say, you know, to the family, because he discussed this regularly with the family.
How does that come in as proof?
Well, it comes in as proof as what a deceased person says. I guess it would be similar to somebody who gets killed in jail. Fortunately, he did discuss this with his wife and his other family members in detail. So we're gonna have to cross that bridge when we come, but we're trying to help him as much as we can.
He told her he hadn't had water for 4 days.
And that's, been the claim.
I don't believe it.
But if somebody wants
to... What makes you think he told her this?
Wife and husband, I know they told her, but because I've been...
How do you know that he told her that he hadn't been given water for 4 days?
I've been told that.
Well, it sounds like you've got just a classic hearsay problem, given that he's passed away.
And
if I could just ask one question, with the indulgence of my colleagues. On the conditions of confinement in the dry cell, what's your best case for the argument, in essence, that keeping him naked and without bedding in that cell was a violation of his rights?
Well, as far as the mattress case, I would say Anello. I mean, one day confinement was enough. And we cited several cases. Another case, I guess, would be Kimbrough, in which it was an Eighth Amendment case. So it was a conviction, and it was only 3 days of abuse. No toilet, I think, the water was given to him at the whim of guards. And I believe there was no mattress in that case.
So Anello and Kimbrough are your two best. Okay. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Longo. Ms. Welsh? Or Ms. Masters, sorry.
Hey, please, the court. And I'm Ms. Masters on behalf of the city defendants. I'm going to be addressing William Atkins' claim that he was not lawfully arrested on the warrant and his bedding claim, and rest on the briefs for any other issues. It's clear that the individual officers had probable cause to arrest and detain this plaintiff, William Atkins, on the outstanding warrant for William Atkins. Even assuming the vehicle stop was unlawful, and I'm going to urge on the court that some of the facts, supposed facts, that plaintiff's counsel just mentioned are actually not in the complaint that is properly before this court. Even if he was arrested prior to the officers running the warrant check, cases such as Green, Tibbs, Johnson, Snowden all say that the discovery of a warrant authorizes arrest on the warrant. And here, that makes sense, of course, because the moment the warrant issues, the person who is the target for the warrant is not allowed to go about freely. He becomes a fugitive, and when we discover him, we are entitled to arrest him, and he cannot claim a Fourth Amendment violation that he was arrested a few moments prior to our discovery of the warrant because he didn't have a right to be wandering around in the first place. So in that instance, it's almost like he's alleging he had a Fourth Amendment.
That would be a great argument if you had. That would be a great argument if you had the right guy.
Right. Well, but we did. In answer to your question about the IDOC number, let me make 2 points. One, there is evidence in the record that the IDOC numbers match.
Where is that evidence?
It's in the summary judgment papers, which are going to be at the district court granted a motion to put those as part of the record, so they will be in the record before this court in a little bit.
They're not yet?
But they're on the warrant and they're on the leads report.
Okay.
And that's going to be part of our record. It isn't now, huh?
Regrettably, there was an oversight on our part in making sure it was before this court in the record. But it is going to be, yes. But William focuses his opening brief on the idea and his reply brief that this was a warrantless arrest, but that argument isn't well taken because the fact of the matter is it was at worst a mistaken arrest on a warrant for which we had probable cause.
Could we get to the nub of the matter here? Let me ask you, in a situation like this, whose responsibility is it? Is it the city's responsibility or the state's responsibility to get the arrestee in front of a court?
Your Honor, it's the state's responsibility particularly under Morrissey versus Brewer, which is a case they discuss. And they discuss all of Mr. Atkins' rights to determinations about whether he was
involved. The state says he's not entitled to get in front of a court, but under Morrissey, and we'll talk about that. But you say when you've got a DOC parole violation warrant, you can skip a Gerstein versus Pugh hearing and just turn him directly over to DOC. That's the city's position?
That is our position.
So as far as you're concerned, the desk sergeant, the booking officer, doesn't have to do anything about getting him to court. The warrant's enough. Even if he protests, he's the wrong guy.
Well, that is our position, based not only because it's because of the rights available to parolees under cases like Morrissey and other state procedures, but also because of Baker, which holds that arrest on a warrant, detention on a warrant, and Tibbs, which is this court's case, that detention on a warrant, particularly for a short period of time when there's been an arrest on a warrant, is fine. And in this case, he was held for less than 24 hours, and we turn him over to the state, and then the state has procedures in place. So we do say that that's not our obligation. And again,
when somebody's arrested on not a parole violation warrant, but a general arrest warrant, who's responsible for getting him in front of a court?
Your Honor, I think the answer is it depends who issued the warrant. So I don't totally know the answer. I don't think I can give you an answer in all circumstances.
What does the desk sergeant do?
Well, according to Hernandez, the desk sergeant helps and as alleged in this complaint, even the desk sergeant does help determine whether we have the right person. So the city does have procedures in place to determine whether or not we have the right person, and this complaint even alleges those procedures that are in accordance with what this court approved of in Hernandez. The desk sergeant, the watch commander, the leads check, there are steps in place that were followed, even according to the allegations in this complaint. I see my time is up, and I know the state would really like its 5 minutes, so if the court doesn't have any further questions, we'll rest on the briefs, and we ask that the judgment be affirmed.
Okay, thank you, Ms. Masters. Ms. Welsh?
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, I'm here on behalf of the state defendants. The question that we're addressing today is whether the judgment for the state defendant should be affirmed, the summary judgment for Director Walker and the 12B6 dismissal for the other state defendants. I'd first like to address Judge Hamilton's question. The plaintiff has never, ever contested the validity of the warrant with regard to him, the facial validity of the warrant. So it's a little late in the game, I think, to say we don't know if this was his number on the warrant. And in fact, throughout the litigation, I don't recall a single instance in which the plaintiff ever suggested that the number on the warrant was not his DOC number.
Does it matter? Does it matter whether that's his number on the warrant or not? If the parole officer who arranged for its issuance just mixed him up and failed to realize there was more than one William Atkins in the files?
Well, I think, Your Honor, it would affect the facial validity of the warrant. If it had an IDOC number for that wasn't his, then I think that would affect the facial validity of the warrant for him.
All right. Let me ask you the same question I asked Ms. Masters. Do you agree it was the state's responsibility to get him in front of a court?
Your Honor, on parole violation warrants, the process that's due is not a Gerstein hearing, but under Morrissey, it's the parole violation.
Right. Didn't Morrissey, though, assume that the right person would actually be the person subjected, who had already been convicted of all and gone through all the processes, so that those more abbreviated and slower procedures could be acceptable?
I don't think Morrissey made that assumption. I don't think it contemplated that possibility. But
so any individual on the street who might be misidentified under a parole warrant is not entitled to get to court?
Correct, Your Honor.
Any of us?
Correct. Okay. I mean, apparently.
You think that's what Morrissey said?
Remember, under Morrissey, what happens is you get a probable cause hearing within 7 days, which the plaintiff admits he had. So he had that hearing initially. It was found that there was probable cause. to hold him over for the parole.
That's a hearing in front of a parole officer.
It's a counselor, but effectively, yes.
Not a judge.
Correct. Because remember, you know, someone who's on a parole violation has been found to have limited.
If you've got the right person, yes.
Right.
So any of us walking the street, though, under your theory, are vulnerable to being held at least 7 days, and then they get to see not a judge but a parole officer.
Well, presumably not all of us, obviously, because not all of us have ID numbers from the Department of Corrections. But
well,
But the thing is, Your Honor, that if a facially, it's the same issue that came up in Hernandez and in Baker. If you have a facially valid warrant, then the people who seize you or beyond a certain number of days, you know, detain you, those people are need to just comply with whatever process is due. I mean, they have a 14th Amendment procedural due process duty, and the 14th Amendment procedural due process duty for someone picked up on a parole violation warrant that is facially valid, even if it might be the wrong person. And here I think we know the most recent amended complaint, that plaintiff is saying, well, either I'm the wrong guy or I'm the right guy, but you miscalculated my parole. I mean, so which two options which are mutually exclusive. Either he is the right guy or he's the wrong guy. You know, either he's the right guy or he's the wrong guy. But you can't say I'm the wrong guy or I'm the right guy. I mean, it seems to me that sort of complaint isn't tenable. So now, again, if you're picked up on a facially valid parole violation warrant, even if it's not for you, even if it turns out to be invalid and issued for no probable cause, what Morrissey tells us is that you have the right to a probable cause hearing quickly. You have the right to, and under state law, he had the right to counsel. He had the right to subpoena documents. He had all of this panoply of rights, which he didn't exercise at his probable cause hearing. And again, then he also had, under state law, as the court held in the prior Atkins case, he had state habeas ability. He could have filed a grievance. He filed grievances for other things. He could have done all of this, and yet he didn't have to go to court. He had plenty of process available to him, both administrative and judicial, and he didn't take any of it.
Would that be a sufficient response, for example, to somebody being held in a jail on an arrest warrant, who's entitled to a Gerstein versus Pugh hearing? Would it be sufficient to say, well, you can file a grievance if we're not taking you to court?
Someone who was arrested on a warrant or warrantless?
Take your pick.
Well, I mean, if you have a warrant, you already have your probable cause hearing.
Not right? If you're the wrong guy.
Not if you're the wrong guy, correct. But then you have the other, but you've had your process. And you might be the wrong guy, but then you have these other procedures like state habeas or so on available to you. If you are the right guy, or if you were not arrested on a warrant, then you have a Gerstein hearing. But you have a probable cause hearing. And here there was a probable cause hearing available to the plaintiff in the form of his preliminary hearing in front of the counselor. And yet he didn't avail himself of the ability to say, look, you know, to please, you know, I want to subpoena my fingerprint records. He didn't do any of that. And he didn't file a grievance. He didn't take it. You cannot complain.
Was he entitled to a lawyer at the probable cause hearing?
Was he
told that?
Yes, because when you get picked up on a parole violation warrant, you get a notice of the reason that you were picked up, and you get told what you can do with it. You know, that you have the right to a lawyer, that you can, you know, ask for documents, blah, blah, blah.
Do we know that happened here?
I'm sorry?
Do we know that that happened here?
Well, we don't. I mean, he didn't allege that, but that is the procedure that's in place.
Could I ask you about the conditions of confinement issue, the water and the drinking? So paragraph 12 of his complaint does allege, you know, he was denied drinking water and food for several days. Doesn't that suggest, serious mistreatment?
There are several answers to that question. First is that it seems not plausible, as the court suggested earlier, under the Iqbal, you know, Twombly,
right.
criteria. It seems that I was a little confused reading the complaint. I have to say whether he meant there was no running water, or whether he was denied running water, or whether he was denied drinking water.
It says drinking water.
I think later on in the complaint, yes, he does say drinking water. But even assuming that that's correct, I mean, one would think that the thing that makes it even less plausible is that the plaintiff didn't allege any physical harm from the denial of food or water. And we know from this case, this court's case in Thompson, that a temporary, remember in Thompson there was a 10-day, the guy was in a filthy, roach-infested cell for 10 days, and that was not an Eighth Amendment violation.
So under your theory, it's not an Eighth Amendment violation to deny somebody food and water for 4 days?
I think that allegation is not plausible given the lack.
Well, what happens to a person physically doesn't have water or other liquid for four days?
Well, precisely, Your Honor. After 5 days, I believe 5 days is the lower end of the limit for death. So it seems particularly implausible that 4 days, that denial of water, that someone was actually denied water for 4 days.
Okay. Okay. Well, thank you very much, Ms. Welsh.
No,
thank you. So, Mr. Longo, your time expired, but we'll give you a minute if you'd like.
Thank you very much. Bonds versus Smith.
You know, that's her point is certainly good. You can't go without any liquid for 4 days without some serious physical consequence.
That's what happened. I don't know.
I don't believe it. Come on now.
I'm just telling you what the facts are, Your Honor. Bonds versus Smith, the Supreme Court said that you have to give prisoners or inmates a right to meaningful access to courts by helping them prepare papers.
No, they don't have to help them prepare papers. That's not Bonds versus Smith. Was there anything to prevent him? Now, Ms. Welsh said that he filed other grievances, so he knew how to. He had the resources, right?
That's not part of this case in the sense that...
Who cares whether it's part of the case? If he's able to file one type of one grievance about something, he can file a grievance about being the wrong person, right?
Well, that grievance was not addressed for quite some time. But still, that presupposes that you know that you should file a grievance because you've been jailed for the wrong...
Well, if you're filing grievances for other things, why wouldn't you file a grievance for mistaken identity?
Maybe you're told that you can only file grievance for...
Oh, come on. There's no allegations about their misleading him about what type of grievances you can file.
I don't know the reason. But I do know that he complained... protested that, please, I'm the wrong guy. Compare my...
We know that. We know that. We know that he said that.
I don't know the reason. But I do know this, that I don't think it can be said that this complaint can be dismissed because no set of facts can state a cause of action. And I do know this. Had they spent just a few minutes, how long does it take to contrast fingerprints? It's been 7 years, and never once have they said that the widow's husband was the man that they wanted. And I do know this, that these three...
What about Ms. Welsh's point that he seems to have equivocated between whether he was the right person, but the duration of his parole had expired, or the wrong person?
No, we're just saying that whatever the reason, he should not have been there, and they should have taken a reasonable avenue of investigation. That's what we're saying. I mean, there's no question that they arrested the wrong man. The wanted man on a parole violation was arrested for some type of sexual crime.
So why did he argue that his parole had been miscalculated? I don't understand.
Just as an added buffer, that he had been in jail previously, a few years before, several years before, he had fulfilled his parole. So we're saying that if they want to come back and say that, that the parole, there was a parole violation relating to him, we're saying that that door is closed also because he had no parole violations. But the bottom line is they were looking for a man who had a sexual crime, parole violation, They ignored him for 37 to 39 days, and they should have just taken a few minutes, had a procedure for such.
Okay, well, thank you, Mr. Longo, and we thank Ms. Masters and Ms. Welsh. Next case for argument, Samira versus Holder, Mr. Stone.